From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! It's ground zero. That's right, it's election day. As millions of eligible voters go to the polls, an equal number will stay away. We'll talk with two experts about why Americans don't vote. And it's been 25 years since 18-year-olds won the right to vote. We'll talk with first-time voters about what today's vote means.
It gives you this sort of confidence that being a citizen of the United States, you can affect things and you can make change. And being that I'm probably one of the only ones voting out of my friends and my family's voting, but it's like it makes you feel like you're one of the top in society. You're one of the top people in society, you know, because most people aren't voting.
And the Christian Coalition has distributed more than 40 million voter guides to get out the vote.
Religious conservatives are clearly the most powerful force in American politics today. It is the most vibrant, the most dynamic, the most energized, and the most well-organized single constituency in the electorate.
But People for the American Way says the guides are full of deceit and distortions. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now!, Public Broadcasting's only daily election show. I'm Amy Goodman. Indonesian businessman James Riady made frequent visits to the White House during half a dozen trips to Washington discussing U.S.-Asian trade relations with the president. And one participant in a Clinton-Riady meeting was international business consultant Mark Middleton, a visitor to the White House 41 times during the past 13 months, this according to Secret Service logs. That's the picture drawn Monday by President Clinton's own chief spokesperson, Mike McCurry, responding to the growing controversy over foreign-linked political donations to the Democratic Party. And just this aside, our producer Julie Drizin went to the National Portrait Gallery this weekend, and there she saw a bronze bust of President Clinton. The plaque under it read, "Donated in honor of Dr. and Mrs. Mokhtar Riady." Yes, Mokhtar is James Riady's father. The family has clearly been serving as a conduit between the Clintons and the Indonesian dictator Suharto. From Maine to Oregon, Senate candidates are racing to the finish line with plenty of suspense over how they'll finish. Polls show that more than a dozen of the Senate races could go either way today. They're that close. Much of the suspense revolves around the 14 seats with no incumbents on the ballot, four of them in southern states. Elsewhere, some veteran senators are fighting tooth and nail to keep their jobs, including Massachusetts Democrat John Kerry and South Dakota Republican Larry Pressler. Late polls indicate the Republicans have a good chance of keeping their Senate majority. Democrats are hoping for a net gain of three seats to recapture the Senate. Hunters and lovers of wildlife are facing off in seven states, and their weapons are ballots. Animal protection activists have gotten a record number of measures on ballots this year. Voters in Idaho, Washington, Michigan, and Massachusetts will decide measures that would ban various combinations of baiting and hounding of bears, cougars, and other wildlife. Colorado voters are being asked to ban traps that clamp the animal's leg, and an Alaska measure would ban aerial tracking of wolves on the same day they're shot. But hunters in Oregon are fighting back. They have an initiative to repeal a 1994 measure that banned the use of dogs and bait to hunt cougars and black bears. Bob Dole is vowing to repeat history. Standing in front of the statue of the late Harry Truman, Dole insisted he, too, would stage an upset victory. He spoke after making an overnight swing, which included stops at a bowling alley in Des Moines, Iowa, and a dance hall in Knoxville, Tennessee. Later today, Dole votes in Russell, Kansas, then heads to Washington for what he hopes will be a victory celebration. For President Clinton, the campaigning is done, and all that's left is to await the will of the voters. After one final campaign stop, a late-night rally in South Dakota, Clinton has flown back to his native Arkansas. A confident Clinton told supporters that the grand finale of this campaign also marks a milestone because it's the last campaign stop of his political career. Ross Perot, just hours away from the voters' final verdict on his second presidential race, planned to cast his ballot today, get a haircut, and spend time at his office. The Reform Party candidate swamped the airwaves on election eve, spending about $2 million on 2 hours' worth of airtime to broadcast four 30-minute infomercials. And Green Party presidential candidate Ralph Nader is working here in Washington, D.C. You're listening to Democracy Now! More of us can vote today, but it's likely fewer will. As many as 90 million eligible Americans may not vote, even though the percentage of Americans who are registered is the highest since 1968. The Committee for the Study of the American Electorate estimates the motor voter law helped increase the number of registered voters by 5 million. But clearly, pundits and pollsters have been asserting in these last few days that today we'll see one of the lowest voter turnouts in U.S. history. In recent years, more and more Americans have concluded that their votes don't matter. This lack of voter participation raises serious questions about the state of our democracy as we cross that bridge to the next century. Joining us now is my co-host, Juan Gonzalez. He is a columnist with the New York Daily News. Welcome, Juan.
Good morning, Amy.
And have you voted yet?
Yes, I have already.
Very good. I did my absentee voting on Sunday. We're also joined in our studio by Rui Teixeira. He is he is of the Economic Policy Institute and author of The Disappearing American Voter. We're also joined by Frances Fox Piven. She's a political scientist at the Graduate Center at the City University of New York and author of Why Americans Don't Vote. Well, tell us, Rui Teixeira, why don't people vote?
Well, in the United States, there are basically a couple of reasons why people might not vote. One is that they find the whole process too onerous, too difficult. And that's one thing at least we've made some progress toward addressing with the Motor Voter and National Voter Registration Act. The other reason is that for various and sundry reasons, voters in the United States tend to have, they seem to feel less motivated, less connected to politics than they do in a lot of other countries. And we may see a lot of that in this election. I have a feeling, judging from the polling data and other data, that people aren't feeling particularly excited about this campaign or particularly connected to the political issues that are involved, and I think they may follow that through by not showing up today.
Frances Fox Piven, what's your assessment of the feeling of American people today?
Well, I agree with Rui that there's a kind of complex interplay between the difficulties that have been placed in the way of voting by sort of the politics of American history and what really calls the motivation of the voters. But I think that that's better understood. This lacks low motivation is better understood as a reflection of the character of our electoral politics. When we have a presidential race that is clearly not competitive. Clinton has been ahead in the polls for a very long time, on the one hand. And on the other hand, campaigns, campaign slogans, campaign advertising that addresses issues that are not very important to Americans, the American people. And, as you know, you began this segment by talking about the campaign finance corruption in connection with the Indonesian money that came from the Riyadis. The significance of that kind of corruption is not only that people sense the system is scandal-ridden, but that the penetration of money means that many of the most important issues don't get raised by either of the political parties, and that affects motivation.
Well, Frances, in your book, I remember reviewing it several years ago when it came out, there seemed to be, one, a lot of analysis of the class breakdown of non-participation, that clearly that it seems to increase, at least in previous years, among working people and among less educated Americans. Have you begun to see any change in recent years? Certainly, I know that the Hispanic registration and voting rate will probably be higher this year, and African Americans have tended to vote more in recent years. Do you see any change? Is the disaffection now greater in the middle classes than it is, let's say, in among working people?
Well, we're going to find that out, I think, in this election. The broader pattern of change seems to me to have been that during the 1960s, when civil rights, late 1960s, when civil rights issues and civil rights victories were very prominent, turnout rose among African Americans, and then it tended to fall back again. So issues do matter. And, of course, in the 1960s, we also had the monumental achievement of the Voting Rights Act, which eliminated some of the barriers that had been put in the way of voting, particularly in the southern states where those barriers affected African Americans. So literacy tests were gone, for example. So there isn't a long-term trend that is visible, excepting that as turnout falls, and it has fallen in the last 30 years, the people who tend to be most affected by that are people with lower incomes. And it's worth pointing out that the class pattern in turnout, where those who are more affluent are much more likely to turn out, those who have less income are less likely, and the less income they have, the less likely they are to turn out, that is directly paralleled by a class pattern in partisan preference. So that you see, and this has been true for some time, but it's most remarkable, it seems to me, in this election, that the higher income people have, the more likely they are to be Republican. So this skew in the pattern of turnout and its causes in procedural barriers and in party appeals is of enormous significance in election outcomes.
Well, Rudy Teixeira, what about the obstacles? Clearly, in most other countries that I'm familiar with, Election Day is usually a holiday or it's usually done on a weekend, whereas in this country, the fact that most people have to work and that there isn't that total attention of the whole nation to the election process could have quite a bit to do with the turnout, wouldn't it? Especially given the fact that Americans increasingly have had to go to work in two-parent families rather than one, so that everybody is working who can, and that creates an even more difficulty in terms of being able to get out to the polls to pay the attention you need to the electoral process. Do you see this as a major obstacle to greater voter participation?
It may be an obstacle of some kind. Political scientists who have studied this question generally tend to think that the issue of an Election Day holiday is probably not a big one. In other words, if it does have a depressing effect on turnout in the U.S., it's probably a small effect rather than a large effect. For example, if it was a holiday, maybe a lot of people would just go off and have a picnic or hang out instead of voting. It's hard to construct the argument that shows that it would necessarily produce a large increase in turnout. And if you try to study it from a kind of quantitative or statistical standpoint, it's hard to see the relationship as being a big one.
You know, Juan and I have both been covering Haiti for a while, and I was down for the election of René Préval, who followed Jean-Bertrand Aristide. And there, the National Democratic Institute was the Republicans' equivalent was down there. But the U.S. government was objecting to the fact that they had placed obstacles in the way of people voting, because in fact only 90% of Haitians were expected to go to the polls and were registered. Compare that to what we have here. Rui Teixeira, can you talk about how the U.S. compares in the world with the number of people who come out to vote?
Okay, if you figure a turnout on the basis of the eligible population as opposed to those registered, because registration is part of the sort of voting system in our country. So, for example, if you look at it in terms of voting age population, which is a good sort of way to compare most countries because everybody's got a voting age, we are basically pretty much at the bottom of this, especially if the advanced democracies, advanced industrial democracies. Switzerland sometimes beats us out for the cellar, but basically the international turnout average is probably close to about 80%. And in the last three presidential elections, we'd average about 53%.
So
we're pretty far below.
Can you actually call this a democracy? I mean, you're talking about President Clinton elected last time with a little over a quarter of the vote?
Well, I guess, I mean, I don't think this is the most desirable situation, but I guess I don't think it necessarily calls our status as a democracy into question, particularly if you essentially, it's possible to simulate what the election results would look like if more people showed up or if everybody showed up. And by and large, you know, particularly in the level of a presidential election or even a House election, the sort of relative prevalence of non-voting doesn't really necessarily affect the outcome terribly much. In other words, if you had 80% turnout instead of 50% turnout in today's presidential election, in all likelihood, the results wouldn't look that different, nor would they have in 1992 or 1988 or most other prominent elections that you can think of. So, I mean, basically what our elections are like in this country is they're sort of a poll, we're essentially polling the electorate, and we have a sample, but it's sort of a biased sample, class biased, as Francis was talking about. But it's not enough of a bias to seriously distort the top line, at least in terms of the outcome.
Except
in other
sometimes.
Words, what you're saying
occasionally.
Is that if 90% of working people voted and only 40% or 50% of middle and upper class people voted, that you still have the same results?
Well, I don't think that that's true. It's sometimes true. But in certain critical elections, there's been a marked disparity between the results that would have occurred if the non-voters had voted and the results that actually did occur. There was a big disparity in 1980. In 1994, when the Gingrich Congress was elected, there was a big disparity. And even in those elections where the difference between voters and non-voters narrows or even disappears, one has to worry about the data because there is a kind of bandwagon effect, so that people who don't vote after the election, who they would have voted for, tend to vote for the winner, join the crowd. But so that's one, but some elections, even that doesn't happen. Even that isn't sufficient to obscure the significant gap between the results that would occur if everyone voted and if only those who turned out the actual results that are produced by the turnout. But there's another part of that that's very important, and that is that politicians and parties, they know who's going to turn out. They have the data, and they craft their appeals and their programs to take account of who customarily turns out, so that those who don't turn out, in a sense, get marginalized from the political system. They get isolated from the dialogue. They don't have the opportunity to, at least symbolically, interact with the political program, with the political agenda. They're obliterated from politics, and that changes the way they think about politics. The way they think about politics.
What about this on a deeper level, the whole issue of whether just even the emphasis on the vote as symptomatic of a healthy democratic process, to what degree has the mass media, the rise especially of television in the last 40, 50 years, reduced more and more the average American to a viewer of the political process rather than a participant, and affected turnout in the view of either or both of you?
Well, it wasn't so great in the past. I mean, we are always in danger because we think that things are bad now, creating a mythical golden age. But there are a couple of changes that television is clearly responsible for. One is that money is more important than ever to the campaigners, to the candidates and the parties. So the reliance on television has sort of sucked all this money into the campaign, and of course those who give the money have influence on the candidates. Another sense in which the reliance on television is important is that when the campaign is conducted entirely through the mass media, and there are no foot soldiers around, the people who used to go door to door, the precinct captains and so forth, and who haven't seen a button in this campaign. Nobody gives out buttons. But not only is it that there's no sort of hands-on, direct, face-to-face contact with the campaign, which is meaningful to some people, but there is no one who, in a sense, helps prospective voters cope with the administrative barriers that are put in the way of voting, like voter registration, which is why Motor Voter is now so important, because there aren't these hordes of campaign workers who used to help people register to vote. No one helps them now, and therefore it's more important than ever that we have an automatic process for taking care of these procedures.
Rui Teixeira, let's give you the last word as we wrap up. And adding to that question about is TV disempowering, the whole emphasis on polls rather than on issues.
Yeah, I think there's truth to that. If you look at the kinds of things that sort of correlate with non-voting. A lot of it has to do with a sense of not being connected to politics, not following politics, not knowing much about politics. And it's not hard to see the possible connection between that and the way campaigns are currently run today. In a sense, the media are now the intermediaries between the average citizen and the politicians and the government. And I don't think that's necessarily adequate to really involve people in politics and make them feel connected to it. So since people kind of tune out the process, partly because their only connection to it is through the media and through the polls, they wind up not voting. And how to correct that, I think, is a difficult question. The motor-voter thing is now in place. It's been implemented in a lot of places. And yet, we may find in this election, we have, perhaps a record low turnout, probably one below 1992, despite the registration reform changes that have taken place. So it's not clear to me that motor-voter is going to really make a huge dent in this voter motivation problem, and that we may have to do some more creative thinking.
Well, it's clearly going to have to be people doing the creative thinking as opposed to politicians, since they seem to be quite satisfied, particularly incumbents. They're there because of exactly the status quo. I want to thank you very much for joining us, Rui Teixeira. He is author of The Disappearing American Voter, and he works over at the Economic Policy Institute here in Washington, D.C. And we've been joined by Professor Francis Fox Piven, who is a political scientist at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York and author of Why Americans Don't Vote. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We'll be back talking about the Christian Coalition's voter guides and others. Stay with us. Listening to Democracy Now!, Pacifica Radio's daily grassroots election show. And yes, folks, it is Election Day. I'm Amy Goodman here in Washington. Juan Gonzalez, columnist for the Daily News, joins us from New York City. Some critics have challenged the legality of the Christian Coalition voter guides. This past Sunday, the Christian Coalition distributed millions of voter guides in churches around the United States, encouraging conservative Christians to go to the polls to help Congress in Republican hands, to help keep Congress in Republican hands. Here's Christian Coalition Director Ralph Reed speaking last month at the National Press Club here in Washington, D.C.
There is a deep and profound spiritual hunger that is driving the American people back to a closer relationship with God. Now, it is ironic that in the midst of all this spiritual and religious ferment, that until recently, people of faith who poured into the public square and into the precincts were treated as oddities, or even worse, as objects of fear. When the religious conservative movement burst upon the national scene, seemingly out of nowhere, too much in the press corps, its leaders were mocked at, its values scoffed, and its adherents were dismissed with the sneering verdict that they were poor, uneducated, and easy to command. They were denounced as mongers of hate, caricatured as snake oil salesmen. They were falsely accused of anti-Semitism and intolerance. And they were derided by one columnist as the American equivalent of Shiite Muslims, managing in a single stroke of a pen to not only offend 40 million Americans, but 100 million Muslims all over the world. Today, happily, that is beginning to change. Religious conservatives have crossed the threshold of legitimacy. They have cleared the bar of credibility in our public life, and they have gained the place at the table that they have sought for so many years. They are not the only voice, but they are an important voice in the conversation that we call democracy. And whether one means them well or ill, they are indisputably going to be a permanent fixture on the American political landscape, probably for the rest of our lives. You see, the American people are hungering for moral answers to moral problems. And that is why the Christian Coalition is poised in the coming weeks to launch the largest single voter education and get out the vote effort in the history of our organization. Between now and November 5th, we will distribute 45 million nonpartisan voter guides in 120,000 churches, an effort that will involve an estimated 100,000 volunteers. They will contact 3 to 5 million voters by letter, by phone, or in person. And there will be an estimated 1 million newly registered evangelical or pro-life Roman Catholic voters who will cast their first ballot 14 days from today. Our voter guides will be distributed across the country, not only in churches, but in synagogues and union halls, at shopping centers and at polling locations, wherever voters can be found. They will accurately report the positions of the candidates on the key issues facing our country, not just the issues that we work on as an organization, but taxes, a balanced budget, term limits, and education. They will not endorse any candidate. They will not urge any voter to join a particular political party, but they will give voters the education and information they need to cast an informed and intelligent ballot.
That's Ralph Reed, director of the Christian Coalition. We made several requests inviting a national spokesperson from the coalition to join us on today's program, but the group did not make any of its staff available. Joining us now to discuss the Christian Coalition's voter guides and their own are two people. We're talking about the power of the Christian Coalition as a political force in 1996. We're joined by Jill Hanauer. She's executive director of the Interfaith Alliance, which distributed its own voter guides this year. The Interfaith Alliance, a faith based countervoice to religious and political extremists, as they describe themselves. And Matt Freeman joins us. He is vice president of People for the American Way, the 300,000 member citizens organization in this country. We're also joined by Juan Gonzalez of the Daily News. Matt, your response to what Ralph Reed has just been saying?
Well, there's a whole lot there to respond to, but on the question of the voters' guides, if Ralph Reed and Pat Robertson and the rest of the Christian Coalition were passing out truly nonpartisan voters' guides that told the voters the truth about the candidates' positions about the issues, I'd help them pass them out myself. But what they're doing is something quite different. When you look at their voters' guides, you see distortion piled upon distortion. They have distorted the issues themselves. They've boiled them down into barely recognizable little blurbs that deliberately deceive voters. They've distorted the candidates' positions on those issues, and they've even tried to deceive voters into thinking that they've actually gotten genuine responses from the candidates themselves to help them fill out these voters' guides, when in fact, in about half of the cases, they have made up answers for the Democratic candidates on their voters' guides, some of which bear little, if any, relationship to the truth. So from top to bottom, these voters' guides are a series of distortions intended specifically to help elect Republican candidates.
Can you give examples of that, saying they made up answers for Democratic candidates?
Sure. Well, they acknowledge right there in their voters' guides, although they have it in the tiniest little type buried by an asterisk, that if the candidates don't respond to their questionnaires, they just go ahead and fill in answers for them. Well, you know, the Christian Coalition has a very different view of a lot of issues than many folks, and so when they go to make up those answers, they come from a different sort of reality. So, for example, they say in the presidential voters' guide that was included in every voters' guide that they passed out anywhere in the country, that Bill Clinton opposes public school choice. Well, that's not his position. He said it in the presidential debates that he favors public school choice. Whatever you may think of the issue, it's not his position. They also say that he opposes a ban on the so-called partial birth abortion. Well, the president vetoed a bill that was a so-called partial birth abortion bill, but he said the reason he did it was because it didn't have a meaningful exception to save the life of the woman or to protect her health, and that if they sent him one that did have that exception, he'd sign it. He said that over and over again. A lot of people I know disagree with that position, but that's his position. But the Christian Coalition boils that down to simply opposes the partial birth abortion ban, and that's not a fair representation of his position.
Jill Hanauer, how are your voter guides any different? Where have you distributed them, and how do you get your information when candidates don't respond?
Well, what we did with our voter's guide was try to talk about family values issues, real issues that affect American families, and those issues that we felt were the most important issues debated in the 104th Congress that affected women and their children and American families. Unlike the Christian Coalition, who cares more about so-called obscene funding of art, or funding of obscene art, or term limits, we think the kind of issues that affect American families are things like Medicaid and Medicare, welfare reform, the environmental protection regulations that were cut back by this last Congress, and other issues like that. What we did, we distributed 5 million voter guides through both the mail and through grassroots distribution. We have 109 chapters in 36 states. And we mailed out those voter guides to low and middle income men and women in this country. The other thing that is very important to remember is that Ralph Reed constantly talks about being persecuted and that Christians are being persecuted, and that's absolutely wrong. Mainstream people of faith joined together with the Interfaith Alliance and other organizations like People for the American Way to say, wait a minute, Ralph Reed and Pat Robertson's agenda is a political agenda masked in religious garb, and that's all it is. So when Ralph Reed talks about spiritual hunger, as we heard at the beginning of this program, we think that what Americans are hungering is truth, and that's something that the Christian Coalition does not give the American public.
Matt Freeman, Ralph Reed also seems to suggest that this religious conservative movement is a new movement on the American scene. And clearly, anybody who knows anything about American history, going back from the Puritans to the temperance movement of the early part of this century, knows that there's been constant revivals of political religious conservative movements within the country. To what degree is the Christian Coalition the mainstay now of the Republican Party, and has that actually hurt Bob Dole in his quest for the presidency this year?
Well, I think the Christian Coalition and the religious right are very much a mainstream of the Republican Party, Juan. And I think, frankly, that is one of the things that's hurt Bob Dole tremendously. I think the biggest millstone that Bob Dole is carrying around his neck is Newt Gingrich and the Republican House of Representatives this past year, and particularly closing down the federal government because of their dispute over the budget. They did that because they were emboldened by their victories in 1994, driven largely by the Christian Coalition and some of these other far right-wing organizations, and they thought they had a certain invincibility to them that would help them get away with some of those issues and to fool the American voters into thinking that those really were mainstream positions. Well, now Bob Dole is paying the price for that, and it looks like it's going to be a pretty severe one indeed.
Let me also point out that the Christian Coalition claimed victory for 38, quote, pro-family freshman members of Congress in 1994, and many of those may not win their re-election. And so what we've seen is, like Matt said, it hurt the presidential, it's hurting these congressional races, and a number of primaries where ultra-conservative Republicans defeated their moderate opponents in Republican primaries for the U.S. Senate, those Republicans are now going on to be defeated. We're seeing that in Illinois, we're seeing that in Georgia. So they really have hurt the ticket up and down.
Jill Hanna, what's been the impact of the Christian Coalition on Catholic voters and on Catholic stands on many of the races?
It's a very good question. Ralph Reed last year created an organization called the Catholic Alliance, which was specifically designed to reach out to so-called conservative Catholic voters. What's happened is he's learned that the Catholic vote is not monolithic, just as the Christian or Jewish vote is not monolithic. And the Catholic Alliance has really been stalled. We're going to see millions of voter guides, or we saw millions of voter guides distributed this Sunday at Catholic churches, focusing on the abortion issue and issues affecting lesbians and gays. But overall, the Catholic vote looks like it's going to split for Democrats and particularly for President Clinton, just as we're seeing now that the white evangelical Christian vote is going probably 35% to 40% to President Clinton.
I also thought the Catholic Alliance bid by the Christian Coalition represented a certain naivete on the part of the Christian Coalition and Ralph Reed and Pat Robertson. They treated the Catholic voter as if abortion was the only issue that he or she cared about. And in fact, Catholics are just about as pro-choice as the rest of the American public is. The polling suggests that Catholics are no more anti-choice than anybody else. So they've really bet on the wrong horse with the Catholic Alliance, and it's be interesting to see how this plays out in coming years.
I believe in terms of actual numbers, Catholics disproportionately get abortions as well. That's a little-known fact. Jill, do you give out the voter guides that the Interfaith Coalition has developed. Do you give them out, the Interfaith Alliance's voter guides, to churches as well?
No, that's a very good question. In fact, on our voter guides, we have printed not to be distributed in houses of worship. One of the things that we so disagree with the Christian Coalition is how they abuse those folks that go to churches and the institution of churches. Because they distribute them in churches, they get them inserted in the programs. A lot of ministers have no idea who the Christian Coalition is. They say the word Christian, they think they are official from the church or from their denomination. And so we have sent, in fact, 50,000 letters across the country to Christian ministers, educating them who the Christian Coalition is and asking them not to distribute their voter guides.
Matt Freeman of People for the American Way, what happened? A couple months ago, we heard that churches were threatened with losing their tax-exempt status if they gave out these voter guides because, in fact, they were partisan. Now, what's happened here? Does this all go the way of campaign finance threats, that if you engage in any kind of illegalities around campaign finance, that you get a slap on the wrist a couple years down the line and maybe have to pay a small fine? What is the law here?
Well, the law is that churches have a certain tax status. I don't want to drag us into the peculiarities of the IRS code, but they have a certain tax status that prohibits them from engaging in partisan electoral activity. Well, that's what these voters' guides are all about. They're designed for the specific purpose of electing specific candidates. So if churches are led by the nose or by the Christian Coalition to passing out these voters' guides, they are very much exposing themselves to the wrath of the IRS. And there are a number of watchdog organizations that are taking a close look at that. The Americans United for Separation of Church and State, for example, I know is working very hard on that issue. And we and at People for the American Way and Americans United have both sent out letters to churches. I think the Interfaith Alliance did the same, warning them about the danger that the Christian Coalition's voters' guides would pose for them. I'd imagine after the election that we are going to see some enforcement actions against some of the churches that passed out these voters' guides. And it's one of the sad and cruel ironies that the Christian Coalition, in the name of God, is dragging some of these churches into this sort of exposure.
And yet $45 million went out this past Sunday.
Yeah, Matt Freeman, in those guides, one of the most interesting things in your analysis to me was how they handled the issue, the very volatile issue, especially in the West and the South, of restrictions on firearms and assault weapons or semi-automatic weapons. How did they distort that particular issue, according to you?
That's a wonderful question, because what the Christian Coalition did was that in their questionnaires to candidates, they asked them if they opposed or supported the federal ban on semi-automatic weapons. And then when about half of the candidates didn't respond to their questionnaire, almost all of them Democrats. So they get back these responses from the Republicans and no responses from the Democrats. And then when they print out their voters' guides, they do two things. First, they make up answers for the Democrats. They divine them out of the whole cloth, or they look at their voting record and then distort that. And then when they put it on the guide, what was asked candidates were asked about semi-automatic weapons, and instead it translates somehow into a federal ban on firearms. Well, if you're a hunter, there's quite a big difference there. You can go out and get your shotgun or rifle and go hunt if there's a ban on semi-automatic weapons, but you can't do it if there's a federal ban on firearms. So you're exactly right. They're focusing those in states where hunting's a big issue because they think they can get out the vote for Republicans that way.
And they explicitly wanted the guides to go out on the last Sunday before the election so that there wouldn't be much time to respond?
That's exactly right. In fact, there was a letter from the president of the Alabama Christian Coalition that went out to churches in that state saying that they were not permitted to pass out the voters' guides until 2 days before the election on this Sunday. We only got some of these voters' guides because we made phone calls to state Christian coalitions and told and asked them to mail them in advance. And to be perfectly candid, we didn't always tell them we were with People for the American Way, and they sent them out to us. And so we actually got some of these voters' guides in advance. But if you didn't think to do that, there's no chance you'd see these voters' guides until about 48 hours before the election.
One thing I want to point out is what we're hearing is, well, Ralph Reed's saying they're distributing $45 million and that there's been an increase in the demand. We're finding that a lot of churches aren't distributing them. And we had folks in North Carolina attend Christian Coalition meetings just last week where activists were complaining that clergy weren't willing to take these guides.
Let's get your phone numbers. If people want to get in touch with the Interfaith Alliance, Jill Hanauer, where do they call?
If you're in the D.C. area, it's 202-639-6370. Across the country, 1-800-510-0969.
That's 1-800-510-0969. And People for the American Way, Matt?
You can call us at 202-467-4999. Or if you're a web browser type, you can check out our webpage at www.pfaw.org. And when you get there, you can take a look at our report on the Christian Coalition's Voters Guides.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for joining us, Matt Freeman, Vice President of People for the American Way, and Jill Hanauer, Executive Director of the Interfaith Alliance. And Juan Gonzalez, thanks for being with us. Juan Gonzalez of the New York Daily News. You're listening to Democracy Now! Up next, we talk with first-time voters. Stay with us. You're listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers, and today is the 25th anniversary of 18-year-olds being able to vote in this country. I'm Amy Goodman, and we're joined by three first-time voters. They're joining us from our sister station in Berkeley, KPFA. They're Chad Andre Reed, Jacinda Abkarian, and Lenora Reyes, and we welcome you to Democracy Now! Well, why don't we begin with Chad Andre Reed? Tell us about who you're going to vote for today.
Okay, I'm voting for Clinton today because I feel that he's the best president to go with as far as he knows what direction that the country will be going in down the line and entering the 21st century. And I feel that all the stuff that he stands on is basically the same stuff that I stand on as far as welfare. He, you know, he really advocates and he just is there for welfare. and the civil rights, he wants affirmative action still in effect. And I believe that in order for this to still be a even country, people still have to have affirmative action in their schools. So there won't be segregation, because that's where we're heading back if we lose affirmative action.
Jacinda Abkarian, we spoke a little earlier, and you said welfare is one of the reasons why you are not voting for President Clinton.
Right. I really saw him as pretty much bowing down to the Republican Party on the issue of welfare when he pretty much just did away with it altogether. I thought that was a move in the wrong direction, especially because he didn't really propose too many organizations that were going to help people out once welfare was cut.
So who are you voting for?
I'm voting for Ralph Nader of the Green Party this election because I believe that he is one of the only candidates that is not controlled by huge corporations, since he does not have any funding from huge corporations. That's probably the reason why he's not going to win, but I'm still going to vote for him because I believe in supporting the Green Party and their efforts, since they are one of the only parties that is focusing a lot on environmental issues and social issues.
Ralph Nader has not gotten a lot of press attention. How did you even know he was running?
Well, I do live in Berkeley, but there are a lot of Green Party supporters in Berkeley and in the Bay Area, and they are putting out a lot of pamphlets about Ralph Nader. Also, MTV, their Rock the Vote campaign has been pretty successful, and actually they put out a pamphlet that did include Ralph Nader as a third party candidate. And also Vibe magazine, it's kind of like a hip-hop R&B pop culture magazine, put out a whole feature about it.
How about Lenora Reyes? Who will you be voting for as a 19-year-old? You're at University of California, Berkeley right now.
Well, not only will I be voting for Bob Dole this election, I will also be in support of the Republican platform, which I think stresses the encouragement of people to work and to work for the benefits that society presents to them. And I think it emphasizes a lot that man is responsible for his place in society, and that you know, you have this opportunity, and I think this opportunity lies with the Republicans and the Republican platform.
Let me ask you, are your parents voting for Bob Dole?
Yes.
And Jacinda Abkarian, your parents for Ralph Nader?
That's right.
And Chad Reed, your parents for Bill Clinton?
Mm-hmm.
Lenora Reyes, did your parents influence the way you were voting?
Yes, I think not only my parents, I think friends and friends' families also had that influence. I was always, you know, like I said, I was always encouraged to engage myself in public life and getting involved with what was going on around in the public and in my community in town. And I think that sort of encouragement to get involved and to have a voice and to speak my voice was the encouragement that lays behind my voting and my voting thoughts and views.
Lenora, Bob Dole has made a major issue of Proposition 209 in California, the so-called California Civil Rights Initiative that would end affirmative action. How do you feel about that?
I'm in full support of that. I think that, you know, for one time, affirmative action at one time did work to encourage, did help women and minorities to get their foot in the door, but I think at it's finally run its course on America and it's beginning to do more harm than good. It's I like to relate it to as like a crutch, and like you have this crutch, and you know, without it you're unable to go anywhere. And I think with it's kind of been built up within people that if they don't have this crutch, they're not going to be able to be anywhere. And it kind of gets away from the self initiative and self reliance. And
Lenora,
it's the very chains holding back people that those chains that they were set to break or to free people.
Do you think that there's no more discrimination?
Oh, I believe there's discrimination, but I think there's means by on which we can resolve other ways to resolve the discrimination. I think that people should. I think Prop 209 needs to be turned more something that's socioeconomic rather than race-based. I don't believe in special preferences and quotas. I think we need to end that sort of thing and look maybe towards more socioeconomics.
Chad Reed, you're 18 years old, you're African-American and Jewish, and you're right now at a community college at Los Medanos in Pittsburgh, California. How do you feel about what Lenora just said?
Well, I can understand where she's coming from and saying that it's a crutch, but to say it's a crutch is kind of funny to me because, I mean, if you look at it as far as, you know, 60 years ago, today is still not an equal society. And of course, people are going to think, well, now that they're seeing all minorities getting into the world and influencing people, I still today am looking for, you know, somebody that best represents me in daily life or on TV. And I really don't see it. And I don't see it coming from out of the school systems. And every day I'm at school, I still see, I mean, even though there's affirmative action and all these other things to help minorities get into school, I still see in everyday life, I still see people that are not influenced by their parents and not influenced by the community to go on to a higher education. So it's like people that are trying to get into school and that are trying to use affirmative action as a benefit to them, it seems like it's still holding them back because of the other people that also do not want to go to school.
Jacinda Abkarian, how do you feel about affirmative action?
Oh, I'm definitely for affirmative action. I'm voting no on 209 because just for the simple fact that affirmative action is not about quotas and it's not about giving preference to somebody because of their race. All it's about is giving people a chance. It's about qualified people competing against each other. We're not talking about a black person getting a white person's job, even if they're underqualified. That's not what the subject is, and people are really getting it mixed up, and it really bothers me, because if somebody gets into a school through affirmative action, all that means is that there were, say, a group of qualified people here and a group of qualified people there, but say the school was all white and they wanted to, you know, have a little cultural diversity, that's just letting people of color or women have a foot in the door to be able to get into that school. It's not about they're underqualified.
Jacinda, Ralph Nader has not come out against California Civil Rights Initiative. I mean, he certainly hasn't endorsed it. What do you feel about that?
I actually support him in not even touching upon the subjects of, say, affirmative action and same-sex marriages and all of these issues, because he does feel that it's going to take away from the bigger, major problems, which are corporate control in America and that type of thing. And so just seeing his stance on most issues, I would actually, I know it's not good to assume, but I would assume he's against Proposition 209, but I think it's okay for him to skirt that issue if he's going to get his main point out.
We're talking to Lenora Reyes, Jacinda Abkarian, and Chad Andre Reed, and they're both first-time voters, at least first-time voting for president. They're also all active in youth radio in Berkeley, California. How does it feel today to know that you're going to be voting for president? Lenora.
Well, I think it's a very exciting thing. I think it's for me. I think it's an opportunity to affect change and to be heard. And I think I'm beginning to feel more part of the enlightened citizenry. I've taken it upon myself to find out about issues, inform myself on issues, and get to know them, and actually possibly influence others as to their decisions or help them to formulate ideas and how they will vote. And
are most of your friends voting?
Yes, majority of my friends are voting.
Chad Andre Reed, how do you feel today?
Well, actually, I feel kind of good. I mean, it gives you this sort of confidence that being a citizen of the United States, you can affect things and you can make change. And being that I'm probably one of the only ones voting out of my friends and my family's voting, but it's like it makes you feel like you're one of the top in society. You're one of the top people in society, you know, because most people aren't voting. So it makes you feel real responsible.
Why do you think most people aren't voting?
I mean, it's from what I heard from my friends, it's like, well, my vote ain't gonna help. And I mean, you know, it's people really don't understand the power that you have. And it's like, the way I refer it to is like record sales. If you look at it, I mean, won't oppose somebody from selling a million records. But if you look at it, if you're that one person, then of course you won't help. But look at the millions of other people that aren't buying records and who aren't voting, and you'll realize the change that you have and the influence that you have over your peers if you go out and vote.
Well, I don't want to keep you guys from voting, so let's just wrap up. Lenora Reyes, let me end by, though, asking, Bob Dole is not known for attracting young voters. What about him appeals to you, and how do you think he can deal with that problem, with that generation gap?
Well, I think I think Bob Dole stresses a lot of individual initiative and being self-reliant, self-sufficient, and that's one thing that I truly believe in. That there are those people that will be there for you and that will be there to help you. But as for me, I don't want to be dependent on that sort of thing. I don't want to be dependent on certain programs or government or whatnot. And I think that Bob Dole really stresses the significance and or the importance of being being an individual in the American society and taking it upon yourself to inform yourself and to get involved with the system or the political process or get involved with anything, any path you choose in life.
Lenora Reyes, what do you plan to do when you get out of UC Berkeley?
I plan to go to law school, become a criminal attorney.
Jacinda Abkarian, how about you? You're at Laney College now, a community college. What are your plans?
I plan to transfer to a four-year university or college and eventually graduate with a degree in journalism or English, either or, and I'd like to teach at the college level eventually.
Chad, how about you?
Well, I also plan to transfer to a four-year university, and I'm pretty open on my major. I mean, I'm into a lot of different things. I'm into fashion. I'm into the music industry, and I'm into a lot of things, and also I'm into making money. So, whichever way I get to make money, I'm willing to go that way.
Well, thank you.
I mean, I'm not gonna sell.
Maybe he'll be a politician.
Well, is that a possibility, Chad?
Yeah, maybe.
How about for you, Jacinda?
Nah, they'd pull up too much dirt on my record.
Lenora?
It's possible, yes. Anything is possible.
Well, I want to thank you all for joining us, Lenora Reyes, Jacinda Abkarian, and Chad Andre Reed. Now, don't let us keep you from voting. Thanks for being with us.
Finally found a friend in a world of enemies. Well, you found somebody you can trust. You found somebody who won't adjust their stance or their pants until election day, until election day.
Election Day by The Previous on their CD, Hard Feelings. Democracy Now! Is produced by Julie Drizin, our engineer, Kenneth Mason, our engineer in New York, Errol Maitland. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. For this Election Day, I'm Amy Goodman for Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!
No, until Election Day, until Election Day,
Standard Time, 9 hours, 59 minutes, 15 seconds. Universal Time, 14 hours.